Welcome to the 13th episode of the Statistically Insignificant Podcast, a show co-hosted by Eric Drysdale and Jared Hunter. We aim to have interesting conversations with the people we know in a wide range of fields, including statistics, economics, and biology. In today's episode, we are joined by Elizabeth Cook, who works as an economist and policy analyst at the Department of Finance in Ottawa. Elizabeth has an expertise in, unsurprisingly, taxation and tax policy. We are looking forward to learning about what it's like to work in the Federal Civil Service in one of the most prestigious departments in Ottawa, as well as how economics training is used for these sorts of roles. Lily, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you both for having me.
So, Lily, as we always do at the start of every podcast, can you just give us a little description of your background, where you're from, what you studied, how you got to where you are in terms of your career?
Sure. So I studied at Queen's University. I did my bachelor's degree there and then my master's as well with you, Eric. So those were some fun times. And I originally grew up in Toronto. I moved to Ottawa later in life, went to school in Kingston, and then ended up back in Ottawa working here at the Department of Finance.
So what is the total number of years, I guess, you've lived in Ottawa in your life? It's the majority, right?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely the majority. I moved here when I was maybe 7 years old. So aside from the time I spent in Kingston for the undergrad and the master's degree, both in economics, I've been in Ottawa.
So are you like an Ottawan? What's the right denonym for that?
I think it's Ottawan, yeah. That's okay. What I hear the most.
All right, TBD. So, Lily, yeah, you mentioned that we studied economics together at Queen's. And one question I have is just because so many of the people that we graduated with went on to different things. A lot of them ended up in the Federal Civil Service. And what's your sense of the skill set that Queen's teaches, like in the economics department? And how relevant was that for actually like the work that you've done since you've been in the civil service for it's 5 or 6 years now?
I think it turned out to be quite relevant. The economics training at Queen's. I'm just a bit surprised, I guess, at which parts were the most relevant. And when we were doing our studies, I'm sure you remember the econometrics classes. And I think a lot of us are really busting our brains over the econometrics there. But as it turns out, that's not what was most important from what I learned at Queen's. It was really just the way of thinking and approaching problems from the economics perspective, having a really good understanding of basic principles and how to approach problems where maybe you have to find your data first and then go from there. All of these skills turned out to be really useful for my job as a policy analyst. And I guess many years have gone by without doing a single regression, but I think the principles we learned behind a regression were still quite useful.
Wow. Okay. So no, not one regression in the last 6 years is what you're saying. That's a bit surprising.
Yeah, no, I think I started doing a SAS course, which I would have gone through the process of doing a regression with large data sets in SAS. But at some point I just stopped it because I realized I was never going to use it. At least not in tax, not in my current position.
Right, fair enough. If I'm hearing you, what you're saying is it sounds like what the best sort of pedagogy would have been really just to focus on doing independent research where you have to tackle these problems of finding the data rather than here's an assignment of this theoretical construction that will never occur, really force people to kind of simulate case-based studies. Is that what you're saying, a more applied economics program designed for the civil service would probably be?
Well, I guess I should qualify this because I have a very narrow experience of the civil service. I've only ever worked at finance in Ottawa in tax policy. And in tax policy, we have access to the micro data. If I were in a different position, for example, we have a division that focuses on evaluation and research. If I were in one of those positions, I might be working on theoretical problems and actually modeling or running regressions. It just so happens that in the work that I've done so far, as it turns out, we're really not doing much modeling. We're not trying to fit trends to data. We're just checking the microdata, seeing what we find in terms of who is using a credit, for example. What are their income levels? What's the gender breakdown? And going from there, really.
Okay, so more actually like summary statistics and like categorical like breakdowns, and that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah, the summary statistics definitely for background information. And then when it comes to evaluating a potential policy, well, it can be really hard to predict who might make use of a new measure or who might benefit from the change in a measure, for example. So often we're not really trying to model that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. What is your sense of how many people kind of studied to be civil servants? Like, did you know going into Queens that your most likely career path was to go to Ottawa and work in the civil service? Like, how many people do you think that applies to? Were they like deliberately studied a program? I mean, obviously like a master's in public administration would be someone who knows they want to go into the civil service. How common is that? And I know you mentioned this is your smaller world of a smaller city in Canada, but still just to get your kind of sense of that.
Well, that's a good question because from my experience in our master's class, for example, I don't really remember what people were aiming for in terms of the jobs they wanted. And I wasn't aiming for the civil service. It just sort of worked out that way. And when I think of the kinds of backgrounds I see at my workplace, there are a lot of economists, and I've seen some public policy backgrounds, but only a few. So I think a lot of people were studying economics and then ended up deciding the civil service was for them. This is just my guess, and that's what happened to me. So maybe I'm a bit biased there.
I wonder actually if you could elaborate a little bit more on that. Like, I'm curious as to, you know, you say you didn't have this necessarily as an end goal when you were doing your master's, but like, what were the kind of sequence events that led you into this position then?
Well, I think when I started the master's program, I was considering whether I wanted to do a PhD or not. So I was deciding between more school or a job. I wasn't even deciding what kind of job I wanted at first. And then once I was leaning more towards finding a job, well, I had already started these recruitment processes, one with the Department of Finance and one with the Competition Bureau. And by the very end of my master's, as these processes were finally wrapping up, I knew that I didn't want to do a PhD. I was pretty sure I wanted to go back to Ottawa because that's where my family is. And well, it turns out most of the civil service is in Ottawa, and I managed to get a job offer, so I just took it.
Yeah, fair enough. I think that's, I look back at how I'm in my career here, where I was formerly working with Eric in like ML and SickKids, and it was just kind of like the opportunities kind of come forward and you have these side goals. And yeah, it's interesting to hear it from another perspective too. You've kind of ended up in this job because you had side goals to go back to Ottawa, and the civil service was a huge employer there, and this was like an excellent position that you landed right out of your master's. I'm wondering though then, like, what's your favorite part of working there? You didn't have a goal to end up there beforehand, but once you've been in the position, I wonder what's really kind of, if there's been like a big spark with you that's kind of driven you to succeed more.
I think that where I'm working right now in tax policy, the big draw are the issues. It's the issues, really. Like, where I'm working right now, we have very small teams and we get to work on a wide range of issues. We get the micro data sent right to us. And there's this really interesting atmosphere, very collegial, a lack of office politics, a bit less pressure, I imagine, than the private sector in some ways, like when it comes to advancing or putting in overtime. So it turned out to be this mostly laid back, yet very stimulating environment that in hindsight, I feel lucky that I ended up here without necessarily trying to get to this specific spot. But I do think looking back that I was drawn a bit towards public service as opposed to the private sector because of this perception of doing some sort of public good. And I do derive satisfaction from that as well in my current position.
Lily, I'm not sure if I've asked you this before. I feel like we've had like an ongoing dialogue about your job for like the last like 5 years. So forgive me if you have answered this question, but I've forgotten if you did, which is, let's say that the Department of Finance is like trying to model the effects of like a a 1% change in some tax rate policy. Like, do they have models that take into account the incentive effects? Like what percent, like, you lose out to, like, evasive behaviors or, like, less transactions or less hours worked kind of thing?
Yes, we do. And there are actually different models depending on which specific area you're working in. So I've mentioned working in tax policy, and I've worked in two divisions. First, the business income tax division, and now the personal income tax division. And each division has their own modeling team and set of models. So when we're introducing a completely new policy, we're not going to run it through a model or try to figure out that way who might actually use this new credit or take advantage of this capital cost allowance rate. But if we're playing with something like a tax bracket, increasing the tax rate on the highest earners, the top tax bracket rate, then yes, that's the sort of thing we would run through a model.
Does everyone use the same models in, like, every finance ministry in the world? Like, so I come from the Bank of Canada. I worked there for 2 years. Everyone uses, like, variations on DSGE models, dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models. Is there, like, some DSGE equivalent for, like, finance departments?
Well, that's a good question, because our quantitative teams are the gatekeepers of these models. And I actually haven't seen in depth, for example, the business income tax and the personal income tax, the models and the code behind them. It's all done in SAS. And this is something like, there's a back end and a front end. As an analyst, I would just be working with, like, the front end, like, putting in inputs and basically seeing what the machine pops out. And it's really the quant team who would, they're the ones who would actually know how to answer your question. I'm sorry, I can't.
Jared, do you want to raise some money to submit an FOI request for that SAS code? We could be pretty specific. Looking for a SAS code?
I would be fascinated to see that. I mean, I don't work with SAS at all. The closest I ever got was R, but that would be a fascinating weekend to dive into that. Probably longer, but yeah.
By the way, Jared, I think the R community would be deeply offended by what you just said there, but that's okay.
Maybe.
Yeah, be careful. Also, the microdata sounds really interesting. Like, this means, like, you have everyone's, like, every tax filer's individual data. Is that what do you mean by microdata?
Well, to some extent, basically there are certain fields on every tax form that the CRA is going to record and then send to us. So we don't get all the data, and we can't identify individuals, for example. At least I don't think we can. I have never figured out a way to do something like that. So it's not super detailed data, but nonetheless, we can see how many people are in each income tax bracket, for example, how many men versus women are earning dividend income, that sort of thing.
Sorry, one last question. Like, in terms of just, like, capturing data, like, are there estimates about how much is of course there must be, like, estimates of how much is unrecorded. Like, you know what I was thinking of recently, Lily, which is, like, there must be so much capital gains in cryptocurrencies that are not being booked in capital gains. Because, you know, sure, like, now there are ETFs where you trade crypto. If you have that in your brokerage account, that's going to get booked at the end of the year. But all the people with, like, wallets and stuff, like, I don't imagine they're going to be submitting claims to CRA, right?
Oh, well, not having ever worked at CRA, I'm really not sure. But I think the OECD is looking at this right now, aren't they? Cryptocurrencies?
Oh, yeah, I have no idea. I know, like, central banks, they want to issue their own digital, like, central bank digital currencies, I think, to kind of, like, cut off, the cryptocurrencies. I'm just more wondering, like, you know, like, there's, like, a lot of the data must be censored or partially missing. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you're not getting the full data at finance, right? Because it's just not everyone's recording this stuff happening, I guess.
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah, there are a lot of cases where we don't necessarily have data on something that we're interested in. So I suppose the cryptocurrency would fall into that category.
There must be something similar. Like, it's a kind of a longer term problem of, like, you know, the informal economy, right? People pay for things in cash, or they don't report necessarily all their income. Do you guys have models that are kind of built into that, error bars or estimates of that kind of behavior? Or is that usually just so small that it's not necessarily concerning?
I think we do have some estimates or at least do some research into the informal economy, but I haven't worked in any of those groups. So,
but I guess one of the kind of the questions I have too is, like, I'm very far removed from this world. Like, I don't have any experience with the Bank of Canada like Eric has. And so I was wondering, could you even give us, like, from your perspective and from your position, like, what's an overview of putting together the federal budget? Because that must be, like, the busiest time of year, right?
Yes, it generally is. And I would say we have, I guess, two major products during the year, at least that I've been involved in from the tax side. And that's the fall economic statement, or the economic and fiscal update, as it was called this year, which just went out on the 14th. And then there's the budget, which is our really big product. And that can take up most of the year, actually. So the process starts when the government starts seeking submissions from stakeholders and industry. And that could be, for example, in the summer or the early fall. And I think that on the analyst side, from the inside, the way the budget process really starts is when you begin writing your briefing notes, probably in the fall. If you're lucky, you saw something coming and you start writing your note like in the summer or even the previous spring. That's happened to me before. So the process is basically receiving a whole bunch of input from stakeholders and industry, and there are the government asks as well. So we sort of divide ourselves up, mentally speaking, into the bureaucrats and our internal proposals, and then the government's proposals, this being the party in power and, for instance, their election promises. So we take all of these inputs, these potential measures, and we write our briefing notes on them. So not every proposal will get a briefing note. We have to prioritize, but we have basically this group of notes that gets batched out and sent up to our assistant deputy minister's office, and then the deputy minister's office, and finally the minister's office, and then it goes to the prime minister. So if a note gets through all these steps and finally goes to the PM and gets decision, that decision could be to be in the budget or not. And at the very end, we take what's going to be in the budget and we start a whole other phase, which is the creation of the budget text itself and all of the communications products that go along with it. Things like questions and answers for the minister or for our managers to help them answer questions from the media. So we'll write up some questions and proposed answers that we think could come up, for instance, at a lockup. And once we do all these comms products and the budget actually goes out, which is probably often in March or April, then we also have some post-budget follow-up, and the legislation itself has to be tabled. So the legislation implementing these measures is usually tabled in two parts, one in the summer, one in the fall, and that's kind of what formally ends the budget process. So when you look at it from that perspective, it's kind of going the full year round. Every summer and fall, we're implementing what we did in the budget last year while we're starting the next budget.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. You'd have probably a better perspective on this, too. I wonder, like, how much of the policies, like, you know, they come up in the spring and the summer, and they're like, this is what we really want to do. How much shift really kind of happens through that whole process all the way until, you know, the following spring when it finally comes up? And has there even been, like, an example that you would find where you were like, oh man, that wasn't what I was expecting back in August, or, you know?
That's actually a really tough question. I think it depends on the proposal. And for example, by the time something goes into a budget implementation act, like one of those summer or fall pieces of legislation that we put out, it could be hard reading the legislation to recognize the original policy because of legalese. It looks completely different from whatever idea you started with. So I think the answer is that it varies a lot.
Wait, Lily, let me make sure I understand here. So there's a flurry of, I guess, notes, like you're trying to get either the civil service or the political side is trying to get kind of sign off on, like, hey, we want a tax credit for like working, like, or a simplified tax credit for working from home. Like that, I assume that was a note at one time that got put into last year's budget, right? But like, there's not notes for everything, right? I mean, like, I assume, is it more like a rule in thing? Like, unless someone rules it in, you're going to go with what last year's budget was, right? Or how does that work? Because there's too many things to have everyone sign off on, isn't there?
Well, I guess everything that we need a decision on would need some sort of briefing note. For the budget process, we write what we call two pagers, and they're not two pages long, but sometimes we write memos. So the note could take a different form, but as long as there's a decision that we're asking for, then there has to be a note written. Some things are automatic, like indexing for inflation. So some measures are just already written into the legislation. Brackets for this tax credit will go up by this prescribed amount every year. That doesn't require a briefing note. But anytime a decision has to be made, there's a note that's being written.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I was kind of thinking about like tax rates. Like there must be like, you know, like thousands of different tax rates for different situations. I assume that like stays roughly constant year to year or has some formula. Right. Like the inclusion of capital gains, like the deduction on that. Like, or does that need to be approved or reapproved every single year that capital gains are treated differently?
No, that it gets written into law. And then until we change it, it stays the same. So, for instance, you could set up a tax credit and say people who earn up to $20,000 can get this tax credit. And if you don't index the $20,000, it will simply never change until you make a decision, regardless of how high in the inflation rate goes.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And wait, can I ask this, kind of a naive question, but like, is there a difference between the words tax credit versus tax rebate? And like, what I'm specifically thinking is something like, you know, in Ontario, we get like some fixed amount back from like the carbon tax. Like it's a rebate. Like it doesn't matter what your income is. Like you get the same amount back. But like other things, like it's basically a reduction on the marginal rate that you have. Is there a different word for those two different things? Like a fixed amount you get back versus like something that's proportional to the marginal rate?
Well, when you say proportional to the marginal rate, do you mean that you would get to deduct this amount against your income?
Yeah. I mean, really,
okay.
Yeah, like things that wealthier people will have more of a rebate on because they're paying a higher marginal rate.
Right. So those would generally be tax deductions. So you're deducting an amount against the money you've earned. And then if whatever you are earning, if it's in the highest tax bracket, well, you're going to get a bigger bang for your buck than if you were deducting that amount, but you had a lower income. And a tax credit just works by taking some sort of base, like, oh, I spent this much on my home office expenditures. Well, sorry, that's a deduction, so I shouldn't use that example. But say you're a film production company, you produced a film, you have X amount of eligible expenditures, and you get a 15% credit. So you get 15% of whatever you spent that's eligible, regardless of how much money you've earned, how much tax you should pay. You get this set amount. So deductions will be more advantageous depending on your marginal tax rate. Tax credits, which are usually set at 15% for individuals, it won't vary. The benefit will be the same, regardless of what income level you're at.
Is the amount I get back, for example, for the carbon tax living in Ontario, is that a tax credit then? Because it's a fixed amount everyone in Ontario gets, from what I understand.
So that one's different. That's called the Climate Action Incentive Payment. Mm. And the government actually posts a schedule on the CRA website, I believe, which indicates each year what the payments will be. So I don't think that actually falls into either category. That's just the government taking the revenues it's got from the carbon pricing framework and then deciding how to pay that out again.
Okay, maybe I'm confused. I thought I got it back on my tax returns, but I might be misremembering that. So.
Oh, yeah, it's through the tax system, but there are some things now, especially with the benefits related to COVID-19, there are benefits that have been getting paid out through tax systems.
I see. Okay, so that's an additional complication, which is just like, there's an infrastructure that you just leverage to give people money, but it's not really part of the tax It's not a tax thing.
Well, it is.
Oh, no.
It is. You can speak delivered through the tax system. It is something that is handled by the tax policy branch, but it's not a tax credit or a deduction. It's just a payment.
So is this form, like these payments, is this new? Because I guess I'm not sure of any payments that have been in the legislation since before the carbon tax. Or are there just examples, like, because I'm pretty uninformed. So you can just tell me I'm just wrong as well.
I think they were implemented more or less at the same time, if not simultaneously, then maybe only shortly after the carbon pricing framework was set in place. I haven't worked on this area personally. This is just what I think based on being sort of a person on the sidelines.
Isn't like the child benefit credit, isn't that like an amount that's independent of your income as well, but uses the tax system to give you money, I think?
Yes. And I think it's also dependent on your income level, the amount that you get. So if I'm not mistaken, it might be referring to people's income on their previous tax return to determine who's eligible for what amount. Or it might even be updated for quarterly data based on your earnings. I'm not really sure how that works, but there's definitely tax implications there.
Oh, yeah. But it's the other way around than like a tax deduction, in the sense that like the less money you make, the more you get of this child thing, right? So like, right. So it's the opposite, which is it has something to do with your marginal rate, but it's not the way that it tax. There's so many complications here, Lily. I mean, I'm having a hard time keeping this all straight, but yeah. Wow. Okay. I understand like why they have to pay you a lot to work in the tax policy group. So much like, you know, balls you're juggling in the air at the same time.
Yeah. Well, it's a pretty busy branch of the department.
So you mentioned the political bureaucratic divide. Can you just tell us a little bit more about that, how that works, kind of what's the culture around that?
Right. So I've been working as an analyst, and I think there's a big difference between the responsibilities of an analyst and a manager, specifically the senior management. So not my direct boss, but like my boss's boss sort of level. The senior management are the ones who actually engage with the political level. And by that, I mean mainly the minister's staff. So I've never had any contact with a staffer or really with the political level in general. At most, when you're an analyst, you'll get comments on your briefing note, or you'll be told to like change the way you write a section, add in new options to a briefing note, that sort of thing. But there's no direct contact there. It's the senior management that handles that. And also the deputy minister works closely with the minister. So I guess at the highest level, that's the political bureaucratic divide, the minister on one side and the deputy minister on the other.
I'm wondering too, if, because you've been in the finance department, I guess, for, was it 7 years?
Yes, it's been just a bit over 7 years. I guess I started back in 2014.
Nice. So I guess I'm curious too, like, well, you're saying the political divide is quite a bit above, like it's way up at even the deputy minister level is the main part. But did you find then from where you're working that going maybe from the Harper administration to the Trudeau administration, or then even from the Trudeau majority into a minority, has that really had an impact on any of your kind of working life at all? I don't know.
Well, I'm unfortunately not a good person to ask about this, because I worked under the Harper government for quite a short period. Like I came in near the end of 2014, and then Liberals came in 2015. So I don't really remember very much of the Harper government. And it was also the beginning of my career, and not having much experience, it's harder to understand what's going on. And now that we've been under the Liberals for a while and we've gone from a majority government to a minority government, I think I'm only now learning what sorts of differences that might make. For instance, just recently I moved into a new position and I'm working more closely with people who deal with communications issues, like writing news releases and following parliamentary processes. And from them I've learned that private members' bills, for example, are more important in a minority government, because when the government doesn't have a majority, they can't vote down a private member's bill. So we have to watch them more closely, for example. And that really is the main thing that jumps out to me right now when you move from a majority government to a minority, because I have to say, if it's affected my work, maybe I just haven't really noticed.
But I guess that does mean you have to kind of be watching from more directions of where the, because I guess it's, there's work that you seem to be doing on these proposals before they get like legislated, right? And so I guess there's just more kind of inputs that could potentially be things you need to troubleshoot or like prepare for.
Right. I think that the risk is still fairly low that a party not in government will end up implementing a measure, but especially during the election period, we had to really follow carefully all the different platforms and figure out what each of the election promises would mean for us. In that sense, like every time there's a changeover in power, there's a lot to do in sort of in terms of monitoring the priorities of each party.
Can you talk about that a bit? This might be a bit of a touchy subject. I don't know how much you can talk about, but if you guys had to do work on like monitoring all the different parties' platforms and their proposals, like what was your take on even the one that would just be the most work for you guys out of all of them? Like which one maybe would have been a biggest divergence or anything like that?
Well, I guess you're asking about the tax policy agendas of each of the parties and which one would have meant the most work for us.
Yeah, at the simplest, I mean, if you were willing to say which one was your favorite, even we could talk about that too, or which one kind of had different ramifications. But I was thinking that might be a little too political.
Well, I guess I should explain that we work in very, very siloed capacities. So when I was looking at election promises, I only looked at the ones that had to do with my area of work. And I never really looked at the bigger picture, if that makes sense, because you would take whatever policies look like they could fall to your section and just analyze them in depth. And I didn't look at the full list of tax policy promises made by all the parties. So I guess I didn't really have an opinion on them. I just analyzed the individual policies that we thought we might be faced with, then waited for the election results, which turned out to be pretty much the same as before the election.
So, Lily, is the reason why finance does this is because the timeline for the budget is so tight, you don't want to have to start things from scratch? Like, what's the advantage of preparing early?
Well, there's always a chance that policies might be such that they should be announced before the budget, whether that's for practical reasons or political reasons or whatever. It could be that you have an election in the summer and there's something that you're supposed to implement in September or October. We would be monitoring for really urgent items like that, but then also getting a jump on analysis for the next budget cycle. Because in addition to whatever the parties that are competing for the election might want to promise people and potentially implement in the future, we also have a whole bunch of housekeeping items that we want to get on the agenda and clear up every year. So we have to work on things that we might want to bring forward in addition to what the government might want to do.
And what's the cultural difference there? What's the sort of notes you want to get across the minister's desk as opposed, like the, I guess qualitatively, right? Like, so when I think of, I'm thinking of like the Ontario provincial election that's coming up, the Liberal candidate leader, Stephen Del Luca, has said, well, we want to have like a winter tires tax credit deduction. I'm guessing that finance employees are not like pushing for, you know, like their instinct is not like we need to have a solution for winter tires in Canada. Like, I assume that like culturally there's like a different focus on what internal kind of pushes are. Do you have a sense of what that is qualitatively?
I think that it's probably more a focus on fixing or maintaining what we already have, as opposed to bringing in new things. For example, if we realize there's a tax loophole somewhere that really ought to be closed, then that's a good example of something we might prioritize internally. Or, for example, we realize that the information we're requesting from certain taxpayers, maybe people who qualify for a certain benefit, isn't sufficient for the CRA to actually conduct their compliance activities. Well, then we'd want to pursue that change and try to get the CRA more information. So things like that, I guess.
And how much of this is duplicate work of the PBO? Like, how is this different? This is more like internal, right? The PBO is meant to be external. Like, do you liaise with them about this stuff?
Not about our proposals, or I guess things that the department itself might bring forward, but there are times in the year when we liaise with the PBO. I think they sometimes release estimates and we might confer with them, talk about our methodologies. We might have estimated the same thing and gotten to a similar or somewhat different answer. So I guess at the analyst level, we would have those kinds of more academic discussions.
I see. Yeah, I mean, just because like from a, you know, like Jared and I, like, you know, we read the political news and we'll hear things about like, I should just say for people that don't know, the PBO is the Parliamentary Budget Office. And like they'll say like, oh, PBO says this policy will cost this much or it will take this long to implement. But like you don't often hear like, oh, finance internal analyses suggest that this will take this long or cost this much, right? Like you guys don't seem to catch the limelight like the way the PBO does. I guess that's on purpose, right?
Right, because when we analyze something, it's usually for the purposes of briefing the minister, and that is cabinet confidence, I believe. So it's just not something that gets released.
This is a comment. So Jared, you know, feel free to comment on this too, or Lily, I'd be curious to your thoughts. And I was only there for 2 years, but my impression was that the Bank of Canada was extremely reticent to analyze the implications of any party's policy. And I think one of the reasons why was like, you don't want a Bank of Canada report saying that, oh, you know, the NDP's policies will shrink GDP and make our inflation target harder to hit, right? Like, right. I think that there's something a little bit more neutral about scoring something in terms of the cost, because you're not making a claim about the benefit or like the impact on GDP or inflation. I don't know. Mm-hmm. That's like one difference that I think I'm sensing here.
Right. I guess we do generally focus when we're looking at a set of proposals or a party platform, we focus on what the costs of certain measures would be. And especially for myself in the tax policy branch, where you're looking at individual tax policies, we're not in a broader research role. We are doing that more sort of focused, objective analysis, as opposed to thinking about what does this mean for Canada as a whole. I do think that there are other parts of the department that are working on this kind of stuff. It's just not what we do in tax.
Something that I'm still a little bit uncertain about is like what, I don't know, in the newspaper, it always seems like the finance department is like budgeted this much, bam, that's what the number's going to be. I'm wondering, is there more truth to that kind of story? Like, what's the nuance? And I know from like working at stats, there's always got to be error bars, but that seems to always get pushed to the wayside. Do you think that, can you give us even an impression of like what those kind of magnitudes are even normally? I don't know. Yeah.
Well, when we're estimating the cost of a measure, I suppose we just take it for granted that it's an estimate and there's some sort of range within which we probably expect this to vary, but we report, we produce one number, say like one number per year over 6 years, and this is the total amount we are estimating it's going to cost, because that's probably the midpoint of our analysis, that sort of approach. But I think the yearly tax expenditure report, where the federal government's tax expenditures are laid out and compared to last year's estimates, sort of gives an example of how we adjust our projections and our estimates over time. And the COVID-19 pandemic is a great example of something that really threw off a bunch of our estimates and that we had to correct for the following year, where some measures may have ended up costing more or less than we originally estimated.
Also, I'd like to make a claim here, and I will probably write a blog post, but I think finances estimates on the tax expenditure cost of the exemption on the primary residence is massively underestimating its true cost. Like, I looked at it, like, the number just didn't seem plausible given how much, like, money is being made on housing in the last year. And maybe they'll revise it next year, but I would just, like, Lily, you don't have to defend your department, but I'm just letting you know, it makes me a bit grumpy, so.
Well, I don't work on housing, so I can't even defend it, so,
Just think about how, just intuitively, just think about how much money has been made with, like, zero tax implications in the housing market, but anyways.
I think our listeners also know that anything to do with housing has always made Eric a little bit grumpy on the show.
All right. So, Lily, just pivoting the conversation away from tax, you're a writer. You've self-published a volume of poetry and a novel. Is there any other thing I'm missing there, or is it just the two so far?
It's those two, yep.
Yeah. And can you tell us a little bit about your writing experience? Like, how do you do that? Like, how does it interact with your day job? Like, do you need, like, a whole day to work on writing? Like, does the mood happen, like, only on some weekends of the year? Like, yeah, anything. Just I'm curious about this because not many people I know are actually writers.
Well, for myself, it's something that I think takes a while to get into. If I could have a whole day to sit and write, that would be great. Realistically, I don't. There's work, which is quite busy, and then any number of other things. I know some people can sit down and write maybe 300 words, half an hour at a time, for example, and I can't really do that. So for myself, it's really a sit down and take a good chunk of your day and try to write something. So lately, I haven't been writing as much because, well, speaking of housing, we moved into a new house and then renovated it. Most of it, we still have more work to do. And I also just started a new position in October. So there's been less time for writing, especially because I like to have those big chunks of time. But I have been writing on my blog, so I find that that's a nice counterpoint where it's easier to write small pieces and it's not like I'm trying to sit down and write another novel.
And we'll include your blog link in the show notes if you're okay with that as well. And so are you one of those writers where reading gives you inspiration? I know some writers, they don't want to read anything when they're writing. I don't know if it's like a jealousy thing or they just don't want their thoughts like polluted by other like novelists. Like, I'm curious about your process when it comes to like other writers when you're writing.
Well, my problem with books, I suppose, is that I tend to binge them. So if I start reading something, I'm probably not going to be writing while I'm reading it because I'm just busy finishing that book. For that reason, I don't really read and write at the same time because I tend to just get sucked into the reading and that's what I'm doing for the next 2 days and that's it sort of thing. But I do think that reading can provide some inspiration. And like you say, maybe there's also a negative side to it where you read something really good or something very different from what you're trying to write, and maybe it could bring forth some doubts about whatever piece you might be working on at the time. So I see two sides to it. It could provide ideas. It could also provide doubts.
And in terms of like the divide between poetry and prose, like, is it the same thing? You need lots of time to work on either, or can you just like write a poem really quickly and whereas like with and then like revise it over time? Whereas like with writing, you need like, you know, 3 hours to kind of write like 300 words kind of thing.
I think once I have an idea, a poem is really quick to write. Whereas if I have an idea and it's for a scene or a chapter in prose format, that takes much longer. And I mean, the poem's just shorter, so that's probably why, but that's my experience.
And do you have, like, who are the poets that have most, like, inspired you? Like, not a lot of people read poetry these days anymore. Are you an avid poetry reader, or is it more like something like a small, like, marginal, like, part of your reading diet?
I haven't really read much poetry, actually. There was the obligatory Shakespeare in high school, and I think I read a book by Rupi Kaur. I'm not sure if I'm saying her name correctly. But aside from then reading the odd piece like Ozymandias and The Lady of Shalott, I think, Eric, you once recited that, so then I went and read the poem. Aside from the odd thing like that, I really haven't read much poetry.
Well, I'm glad I made you at least a partial Tennyson fan. Well, I don't know if that's not exactly what you just said, but I hope that's what happened anyway.
Oh, no, I really enjoyed it. It's just, for some reason, I don't go seeking out poetry to read. I'm always looking for novels.
Fair enough.
I was just curious about the reading, and I was wondering if you had any quick novel recommendations.
One I really enjoyed, I think it's called Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke. And it's a fantasy novel, but it's written in a very amusing way, I think. And one of the things I noticed when I opened it was that it was using footnotes and sort of citations, which turned out to really add a lot of color to the narrative. And yeah, that's a book that I read a couple years ago and left a strong lasting impression.
So Lily, judging from your Goodreads list, I think you mainly read fiction. Do you have any nonfiction that you've read in like the last year or so that you've liked?
I read a couple very poor nonfiction books, actually. So looking back on the last year or so, I don't have any nonfiction recommendations that I can think of off the top of my head.
Fair enough. Jared, you might appreciate this too. I seem to remember about the Netflix challenge that happened I feel like it was almost like more than 10 years ago now with machine learning, which was that actually besides just recommending movies or books based on the things like you like, oh, you both like these sorts of books, you're probably like this book. Like you can also do recommendations based on books or movies people dislike. Like, oh, because you dislike this book, you might like this book, you know? And I feel like it's definitely an underutilized system in recommendation algorithms these days because people don't like the negative. But I feel like we should learn to embrace it, to be honest.
Are you trying to pressure her into giving her most hated books right now? Is that what's happening?
Maybe, but this is like a casual no pressure show. So, go ahead, Jared.
I did actually have one other topic that I was curious about, the importance of bilingualism in the civil service and what, from your kind of personal perspective, what you've seen of that.
Well, I think there are two ways of thinking about bilingualism in the civil service. And one is in terms of personal advancement, and the other one is more in terms of contributing or participating in the workplace. So when it comes to your advancement as an analyst, for example, you might start out in a position that is something called English essential or French essential. This is a position where you don't actually have to know any of the other language. In an English essential position, you don't need to know any French. But there aren't that many positions like this. Most positions are bilingual. So for most analysts, at a very basic level, you have to attain a certain competence, and it's not a very high competence, in French or English to qualify for your position. Then if you want to advance to become a senior analyst, or especially if you want to become a manager, then the requirements are greater in terms of the amount of French or English, whichever is your second language, you have to be able to speak, read, and write. So for those who want to, I guess, progress their career, go into management, or even go into a different area like IT or HR, places where you need to be able to work with people in both languages, it is quite important to be bilingual to some extent, well, to a great extent. And then when it comes to workplace participation, being able to be a part of events and give presentations, for example, in both English and French, that's going to be something that you choose for yourself if that's how you want to experience your workplace and, I guess, just enrich your own experience. Like being able to understand your colleagues when they're chatting in French, as opposed to only understanding if they're chatting in English. These are just two very different experiences of the workplace.
Yeah, fair enough. If you were to meet someone who's like, I want to be an analyst in the finance department, would you recommend them going to get the French? Do you think that that's something that, you know, you would need to probably do from in a more formal educational setting? Or do you think that to be able to get the level that you would need to advance fairly well, you wouldn't necessarily need to do that beforehand?
I don't think you would need that sort of training beforehand. But once you enter a department, well, every department's different, but here at finance, once you're in, you can get French training. You just have to hear it with your manager. And managers are generally quite enthusiastic for people to pursue language training, especially when you first get in, because they know that it's going to provide you that base to improve your skills in either French or English.
Nice. That's interesting. I didn't know there would be, I mean, I should have assumed, I guess I was being naive, but I didn't know there would be such a infrastructure of being able to give that to civil servants who are already in the department, I guess.
Well, I don't know how it's been going since the start of the pandemic, whether there have been as many French lessons going on, for example, as before the pandemic started. I participated in one very short virtual preparation course in French for an oral exam, which was then done over the telephone, because we can't do it in person right now. So there are some solutions in place, and there's definitely French training still happening. But back when we were in the office, there was just a room on the same floor that HR was on, and you could go down there and you would have your class with maybe 10 other people, and you could spend a couple hours there. Or I think there were classes that were either the full morning or the full afternoon. I guess my memory is getting a little fuzzy since we've last been in the office.
It feels like it has been forever, just as a COVID note. But anyway, yeah.
All right. So Lily, we're going to move to the last part of the show where we always end with an underrated versus overrated. So I throw out just like a word or like a sentence, and we want to get your thought about whether this thing, concept, idea is underrated, overrated, neutral, or feel free to pass if you don't want to make a comment. Does that sound good with you?
Okay.
All right. The first one, the expression QED.
I think overrated, but I'm not sure I can explain why. This is just a gut reaction.
Do you think it's a bit obnoxious, Lily?
Maybe that's it. Maybe it feels a little pompous in a way. I'm not really sure.
Okay. Fair enough. All right. Number two, doctorates.
Oh, I'll say neutral. Because on the one hand, I mean, doctorates are very useful for obvious reasons. On the other hand, I think people sometimes go through a lot of suffering to get them. So I'm not really sure about that one.
Do you think that in general equilibrium that we have too many PhDs currently?
I'll have to pass. I just don't know.
Fair. All right. Japan is a tourist destination.
Well, I think it's underrated, but I've been there twice and loved it. So that's my personal bias.
Whereabouts did you go in Japan?
Well, mostly around Tokyo and Kyoto. So not all the way north to Hokkaido, for example, but more in the central area. And Kyoto is just so beautiful. I mean, you could just do a trip to Kyoto alone.
All right. Number four, Regency romance novels.
Underrated. Well, I love them. I think they're hilarious, regardless sometimes of whether they're good or not.
Also, when was the Regency period? Like, does anyone actually know? Like, I could tell you it's before the Victorian era, but that's about it.
Right. No, there is a set period, and I think it's roughly 1800 to 1812, something like that. It might be broader, but before the Victorian period, for sure.
What's the stereotype for people that don't know? Like, what's a caricature of what happened in the Regency era? Like, I imagine I have like this image of like women in very tight corsets and people saying, "My lord," a lot. Like, is that about right?
Well, there actually weren't corsets that were part of the usual dress in that period. There was an empire waist. But I think the stereotype, or, well, also the gold standard, it's Pride and Prejudice, and it's just the witty banter, and these people, this landed class, the gentry, going about their days when, frankly, they didn't have a lot to do.
My next one is Jeeves and Wooster.
Oh, I think underrated today. I think a lot of people just haven't read P.G. Wodehouse and don't really appreciate those books anymore.
Okay, and last one, Total Factor Productivity.
Maybe underrated. I'm not sure we pay enough attention to productivity these days. I think we should pay more attention, I suppose. That's why I would say underrated.
In Canada, like, this is, I'm not mistaken, right? Canada has like a very bad track record of productivity growth within like developed economies. Is that correct?
I think abysmal. And it's been abysmal for quite some time, actually. And, you know, I'm just remembering earlier I was saying in tax, we don't really model impacts on the economy overall. And that's true of individual measures, but we do take a step back from time to time and look at, well, what's our productivity like? What's our creative destruction looking like? How does our tax system contribute to this or maybe not affect it at all? So yeah, that just brought up a whole host of thoughts for me.
I saw an article yesterday that like the median age of Canada's like largest companies is 122 years old.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah, yeah. So that gives a sense of the creative destruction going on. TD, RBC, you know, they've been around forever, I guess.
Okay. Oh, I didn't know that.
But anyways, so Lily, thank you so much for being our guest today. We'd like to thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Well, thank you both.